Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Good morning. It's the word.
Not much, kind sir, but you know, Payne, we look at our podcast as a safe space for you and I as co-hosts of this esteemed product that we put out. We like to think of it as such for our listeners as well. And I think there's a humanizing element to an activity that you attended last night that our listeners might love to actually hear about.
No clue what you're talking about.
Payne, this is a safe space. You can share with us. You can reveal your innermost, deepest, darkest secrets and let people know what you did.
Big hockey fan. Went to a hockey game last night. There you go.
So proud. It warms my heart. For those folks that don't know, Payne is I don't think it's a closet, but a big-time Penguins fan. And yeah. So you came out of your bubble. You attended a National Hockey League game that had no sorts of long-term ramifications in the grand scheme of things. Did you stay for the full three periods?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. No question. And I actually debated because I was like, yeah, you know, I kind of want to go, but it's going to throw off my schedule. Obviously, we have like no time during football season, but I kind of crammed some things in and said, okay, let's do this. Because the next game, they do have two in Florida this year. The next time Pittsburgh's down here isn't until after the Super Bowl. So I was like, let me go there. Although, again, there's a lot of humans at these games, which is, you know, not really my thing.
So you're telling us the first time that we do our Bet the Board meet and greet official gathering, we have to keep it to a small, tight-knit circle to keep you from getting anxiety?
I mean, there was like thousands of people there. I had anxiety when I first walked in the building. I'm like, you know, Jesus, there's a lot of people here. But after, you know, I got settled into the seat and, you know, the game got going, it's like, this getting out isn't half bad.
And at least you got to see Matt Murray give up one of the worst goals that might be surrendered at all during the National Hockey League season.
Did you finally see it?
I've seen it. I haven't seen it in the entirety of how the play developed, but it's not exactly a good recipe for success when you make a save with your blocker, the puck pops straight up in the air and hits your back and rolls into the net.
I would say Pittsburgh got pretty unlucky last night. There was a lot of situations where they had some point-blank stuff that just didn't go in.
All about puck luck over the course of an 82-game regular season, but 2 minutes is about all we can spare for hockey talk. We got plenty of college football. Week 9, I think we're in, as the calendar inches ever so close to November and us getting a better idea of the landscape. So what better place to start, Payne, than with an undefeated team in East Lansing, and no, of course, it's not the Michigan State Spartans, but it's Penn State putting their undefeated record. No, exactly. Putting their undefeated record on the line. And current number at FoxBet, you're looking at Penn State, a 6.5-point favorite, total on the game, 44.5. And I guess the biggest question, as we get late in the season, you have one team coming in off a bye. You have another team that's played back-to-back emotional games. How should we go about trying to quantify or allow the additional rest for a team like Michigan State to impact our handicap of the number, knowing what Penn State's had to go through over the last 2 weeks?
I think you have to factor it, right? Especially when you have a group of young kids, right? Sometimes their focus isn't narrowed in on one specific task, but when you get a bye, a game, and then another bye, right? You're pretty much lined up for Penn State, and you have a young team in the Nittany Lions who, you know, you just start to wonder if things catch up to them. You know, third straight monster game, young team, and Michigan State's a veteran group. So I think you're going to see a team just listening to everything this week that's really focused on regrouping after this bye and not having their season completely go awry.
Well, it's hard not to want to regroup given what we saw from Michigan State, especially on the defensive side in back-to-back losses against Ohio State and Wisconsin. And we'll get to that in a minute. And you mentioned Penn State. I mean, this is a program that accomplished a major feat last weekend, beating ranked opponents in consecutive weeks for the first time since 2005. So we'll see how they handle Prosperity. But I think what's interesting about Sparty on the other side, since winning the Big Ten back in 2015, they're actually one game under 500 in conference. Now, long losing streaks haven't exactly been part of the Coach D'Antonio reign. Just three losing streaks of three or more games in 13 years. They've had Penn State's number. But the side of the ball I want to start on, I think, Payne, is Michigan State's offense against a Penn State defense. We've seen Michigan State really flounder, and that might be an insult to a fish out of water when it steps up in class and has to actually move the football against a living, breathing defense.
Yeah, and like to your point there, you watch more football, at least college football, than I do. So you've been ahead of the metrics this season when, you know, assessing Michigan State's offense, and I think you've kind of proven to be right. The three best defenses Michigan State's faced so far was Ohio State, Wisconsin, Arizona State, and 17 points combined in those three games. So to me, when I looked, and it's, you know, simply by the metrics, they went from 112th in offensive efficiency last season to 52nd prior to the Ohio State and Wisconsin games. That wasn't enough improvement, apparently, to show on the scoreboard. Even coming into like this game right now, Michigan State 71st in offensive efficiency. So like the improvement showing metrically, I don't know how it's going to look this week because we know PSU's defense is fantastic. I thought it was going to be a top five defense to start the season. Right now, number two in overall success rate allowed. Literally, opponents are successful on 28% of their offensive snaps against Penn State. So pretty ridiculous there. PSU does a good job stopping the run. So from the onset, you think this is probably going to be a game that's on Brian Lewerke's shoulders, unless there's some type of, I don't know, drop down here, right? 38 minutes on the field last week against Michigan, 82 defensive snaps. If that comes into play where they're a little fatigued, maybe Michigan State can create some movement in the ground game with Elijah. I don't know. I'm intrigued to see what Lewerke can do here. The key thing for me, and I think it's probably been a big part of those three losses against those superior defenses, you have to eliminate mistakes, right? When you do get into the green zone, you have to be better situationally with your offense. You have to finish drives. So, you know, you can't turn it over three times like you did against Ohio State. Two of those early fumbles were like just gift wrapped. In that game when Sparty did get inside the Ohio State 40, 2.5 points per trip was the result. So when you look on the season, situationally, the offense hasn't been good. 89th in points per trip inside the 40. That's got to change here. The other thing, and it's pretty noticeable, I want to see if Sparty's figured out some things during the bye because they've had some depth issues on offense, right? Like long term, there's been like five or six guys, and there's probably going to be three more from what I'm hearing that are going to transfer out of the Michigan State program, right? They put their name in the portal, but they're depth guys, right? They're like three running backs that have put their name in the portal. So like Elijah Collins, he's been an upgrade as a runner, but he's not good in pass protection. So like with these transfers, if you saw recently, like Michigan State's using a tight end at running back on passing downs to help in protection. And like, I know it's a known passing down, but like you put a tight end out there, it removes any doubt of what's coming when you have a tight end at running back. So I think looking at the depth chart this week, there's been a lot of movement there. I think the bye week was good in terms of getting these young guys up and ready to contribute now that there's been a lot of these defections in the transferring out.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing, and I think Michigan State is the modern-day example and the perfect encapsulation of what you need in college football. You need that big play explosive potential, and right now the Spartans have none of that. The ability to hit the home run, shift momentum, they have to be slow, they have to be methodical, and when you have a quarterback like Brian Lewerke with limited weapons and a banged-up offensive line, not exactly the recipe for success. And I think what we've seen there is Michigan State struggles offensively, Payne. The defense is broken down as well because the defense coming into the season, led by Kenny Willekes, was supposed to be the strength of this unit. Well, you look at the last three games they played, and I know they beat Indiana scoring 40 points, which I thought was them turning the corner offensively. Turns out it wasn't the case. When they stepped up in class, they got knocked down. But they've now given up 30-plus points in three straight games. They surrender 545 total rushing yards in back-to-back losses against Ohio State and Wisconsin. Now, Penn State, they don't have the same dynamic playmakers at running back of Jonathan Taylor, J.K. Dobbins, or Master Teague. Let's not sugarcoat any of that kind of stuff. But they do have an explosive game breaker in K.J. Hamler. Can Michigan State do enough to take away Penn State's biggest home run threat and make Sean Clifford show that he can consistently drive the Nittany Lions down the field, dink and dunking his way to methodical drives?
You have to hope, right? If you're on Michigan State. When I look at what Penn State's done offensively, they've survived on big plays, at least last week. They had seven total explosive plays. Six of them came on the four drives that resulted in touchdowns. So explosive plays were Penn State's saving grace against Michigan. When you look efficient, you know, from an efficiency standpoint, Clifford and the PSU offense didn't really move the ball all that well after the first quarter. And we talk about success rate all the time. The national average is 41%. And so when you look at PSU, 27% success rate in the second quarter, 8% in the third, and 31% in the fourth. So Michigan outgained PSU by 134 yards. 2 weeks ago, and it's a game that I hate to bring up again, PSU was outgained by a full yard per play at Iowa. So
I thought we buried that game. Why do you have to bring it up? I thought that game was buried and done.
I don't know what we're really seeing here from, you know, Penn State's offense. Now, to your point, and it's tough to say this about a defense right now in Michigan State, that's 11th in overall efficiency. And they have, of course, you know, played back-to-back games against Ohio State and Wisconsin. So that's included in those data points, really good offenses. But I think, you know, you kind of hit this out of the park. We have to worry about what Michigan State is on that side of the ball, right? We thought this was going to be a defense that led the way. It was a veteran group. They were going to rely on that unit. It was going to be the heart and soul. It was going to be this team's DNA. Three straight games have given up 30 or more points. When you really try to figure out what's going on here and look at Sparty's defense from every single level, they are awesome stopping the run. Number one in adjusted line yards, seventh in stuff rate. So this is going to be a game, in my mind, that is on Sean Clifford and KJ Hamler's shoulders, right? Where the drop-off comes from, and I just spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the hell was going on with this defense. Sparty's having issues defending the pass, right? 61st in passing success rate defense, 58th in defensive pass efficiency. Last season, Michigan State's defense was top 10 defending the pass on both standard downs and passing downs. So the other thing that's really interesting here, and maybe it's, you know, a little bit of misfortune, you know, a little unluckiness. Sparty's been really solid with their early down defense, top 25 in both first and second down success rate allowed. And, you know, you watch these games closer again, but the metrics say Sparty's having trouble right now getting off the field on third down. 74th in the country in third down success rate. Now, you know, again, to the point is third down defense, a lot of it is luck. It's not overly repeatable season over season. It's why third down metrics aren't really discussed much anymore by those, you know, that really do this and are in the know, right? Because a large part of your, you know, a large percentage of your third down success, both offensively and defensively, it's a byproduct of what happens on early downs, right? It's why you see these drastic swings for teams on third down year over year. So to me, like, this matchup is clear. Like Sparty has to continue doing what they've done all season, right? Stop the run, make Penn State one-dimensional. If you can shut down what appears to be now, again, a four-back rotation for Penn State and Clifford on these designed runs, they should be okay. And then it just comes down to getting off the field on third down. That is a really tough task with KJ Hamler, honestly. And if I see another slow Big Ten defense try to defend KJ Hamler with a linebacker, I may jump off a cliff. Okay. But, you know, Clifford wants to find Hamler any chance he can get, right? Last week, Clifford had a perfect passer rating when targeting Hamler. So it's obvious where he wants to go with this. The other, you know, game within the game here, both units are, you know, where they've been inconsistent and struggled a little bit. Sparty hasn't been able to get pressure. And PSU, when you look at their offensive line on passing downs, 112th in the country in pass protection. Which one of these units kind of rises to the occasion, outperforms their season-long metrics, probably is going to decide who covers this game, I would think, and maybe even wins it.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned KJ Hamler and what he's been able to do so far this season. 563 yards receiving. No other Penn State Nittany Lion has gone over 300 over his last couple of games. 13 catches, 169 yards, 3 touchdowns, career high 7 touchdowns this season, averaging over 17 yards per catch. So you talk about big play potential. He is the poster child for that. We'll see if Coach D'Antonio can right the ship, as Michigan State has kind of said, hey, we have a couple big games left on the docket. We'd love to win rivalry games against Penn State and Michigan, knowing that a conference championship is very much out of the equation. From the Big Ten, though, to the Big 12, and Dallas-Fort Worth will be the site of an intrastate showdown between TCU and Texas Payne, with Texas a one-point road favorite, total in the game 59.5 at FoxBet. And when you look at the recent history in this rivalry, TCU has gone 5-2 versus Texas. Last year, they, of course, saw a four-year winning streak against the Longhorns snapped, losing that game 31-16. And if you poke around and do some reading, you might not recognize TCU when they get on the football field, because they're going to sport one of the more ridiculous uniform combinations that we'll see so far this season that I can't represent for you visually. But TCU comes into this game. They come into this one pain off back-to-back road losses against Iowa State and Kansas State. Texas after a razor-thin victory against Kansas, where their defense was shredded. And I look at this matchup on the field, and I wonder, can this Texas defense hold up against the physically imposing pounding ground style that Gary Patterson and company want to employ?
I think TCU probably has some success running the ball, right? And when you incorporate rush attempts from running backs and with Max Duggan's legs, TCU right now 25th in the country in rushing success rate, top 45 in explosive runs. So I think TCU, to your point, has a decent advantage on paper with their ground game here. But I really think if TCU is going to win this game, Max Duggan has to hit Texas where it's most vulnerable. And you hinted at that. And it's through the air. And I think that's a big question mark right now. You know, freshman quarterback is just graduated from high school a handful of months ago. It's a tough ask for him to be this experienced passer. But bottom line is, like, you look at Max Duggan right now, hasn't shown to be overly accurate, lacks the, you know, the right amount of touch on the ball, hasn't been able to lead receivers properly yet. But if Duggan can get hot this week, I think there's a ton of plays to be had against this, you know, beaten and battered Texas secondary. It's bad on bad, though. TCU successful on 35% of its passes, 102nd in the country. Texas, 102nd in the country in passing success rate defense. And I feel like, Todd, we've kind of hit on this for like years. Texas gives up just like gobs of explosive passes. This season, no different. But TCU, 91st in the country in explosive passing. So Duggan's going to have to figure out how to take advantage of this secondary. For Texas defensively, potentially positive. Their corner, Jalen Green, he was back at practice on Monday. He's going to have to go through the padded portion of practice this week to be cleared. He had a separated shoulder in the LSU game. BJ Foster just kind of like gutting it out right now, has a separated shoulder as well. You can tell he's just not like hitting anybody. He's not initiating contact. We'll see if he goes. Brandon Jones suffered a stinger against Kansas. They're calling it a stinger, but he didn't return in the game. This was a Texas defense that was going to be starting 9 new guys heading into the season anyways. Now there's like literally 6 guys that are injured that were going to be relied on as key contributors. So like Todd Orlando's unit is you know, putting this nicely. They're struggling. We saw Kansas last week. They entered the Longhorns green zone on 10 of their 13 possessions. So if TCU can replicate something like that and get into the money zone, they have to finish with 7s. For as good as TCU's been on the ground, right, and you have a mobile quarterback, their points per trip in the green zone, just 73rd in the country. So that has to improve here. So if you can get the ground game going, if Duggan can do enough with his arm to exploit that Texas weakness in the secondary, and you can convert for touchdowns, I think there's probably going to be a lot of happy Horned Frog people here.
You know, when you look at Texas, they rank last in pass defense and almost last in total defense in the Big 12. They've allowed 300-yard rushers the last 2 weeks and can't pressure without a blitz. The defensive line has just 2 sacks on the season. You mentioned some of those injuries, and we didn't even get DeMarvian Overshawn, and they're dealing with a shoulder pain after the Kansas game. And BJ Foster, you feel bad for the kid, but when your own beat writers basically, and I took this pain from one of the articles, B.J. Foster had 5 tackles in Saturday's game, including a half tackle for loss, but did look reticent to attempt tackles with his left arm in the open field. Not exactly ideal when you're going to have to encounter a physically imposing ground game. There's very few corners who've been able to make a living when they're reticent to attempt tackles outside of your beloved Deion Sanders. So when we
taking
look
shots,
at
taking
I mean,
shots.
I got to take
if you
shots
watch
here.
If you watch the Oklahoma game, you could tell he was hesitant making tackles. There was a play that was ended up in an explosive play down the sidelines, and he's kind of just like shadowing the ball carrier, just kind of trying to figure out the best way to make his move to tackle him. He's clearly playing through pain. Now he's the leader of the defense. They're relying on him. So kudos to him for, you know, trying to gut it out and play and be there for his team when he's, you know, not getting paid. So I don't want to bash the kid too much, but yes, he is a shell of himself right now.
And you mentioned Todd Orlando, Tom Herman calling him out publicly, basically saying they need more from the defense. Good yeah. luck. Good luck yeah. in
they've
that
actually,
particular.
I was reading this too. They've given up the most passing yards in the entire country in the second half of games as well.
Oh, Kansas did what they wanted when they wanted in that fourth quarter. I mean, Carter Stanley looked like the second coming of Tua Tagovailoa out there, just chucking the ball all over the place. And that Kansas defense ultimately let him down.
I thought he got injured. I thought he was in an ambulance or something.
No ambulance. just slinging it all over, making it look like it was 7-on-7 ball. Gotcha. Other side of the football, though, clearly Texas's strength, and they're led by a veteran leader in Sam Ehlinger. But when you look at Texas, the common denominator in their two losses, Payne, are games against Oklahoma and LSU where they weren't able to run the football effectively. 100 yards rushing against Oklahoma, less than 3 yards per carry. A shade more than 3 yards per carry in that home loss against LSU, 121 total. And at TCU's credit, they've only allowed more than 118 rushing yards once. That came in a blowout loss against Iowa State. When I look at TCU's defense, do we think they can neutralize some of what Texas wants to do and subsequently take a little bit of the pressure off Max Duggan and his inability to exploit that Texas defense through the air?
You made it sound easy. I don't know if that's going to be the case. Sam Ehlinger is really taking the next step, right? That offense has been electric because of him. And if you look and you, again, watch all these games, I think there's some holes offensively for Texas, right? The offensive line. I think they're playing way better than expectation. They've been great in terms of the holes they're creating and space they're creating in the ground game, but they're outside the top 90 in sack rate allowed on both standard downs and passing downs. Colin Johnson even missed some time, and the offense didn't really skip a beat. And because you look, Ehlinger doesn't always have time to throw, and Colin Johnson has been out for some games. Texas isn't overly efficient through the air, 84th in explosive passing. So, like, despite some of these issues that are, you know, pretty correlated to one another, Texas has the sixth most efficient offense in college football. Top 25 in both passing and rushing success rate. So it's a really balanced offense. I'm still trying to figure out what TCU is defensively. From what I've seen, not as good as the metrics indicate. You look and like Gary Patterson's defense has only allowed 33% of snaps against his defense to great successful. It's 11th best in the country. But in terms of overall defensive efficiency, which incorporates every metric under the sun, TCU is 32nd because they've given up big plays through the air, because they have some issues getting pressure on opposing quarterbacks. And listen, you know, it's 2019, right? When you can't get pressure on these new pass happy offenses, it's going to equal big plays. And when you look at this, TCU, 112th in explosive pass defense. So it's all correlated. The other thing TCU has been poor at defensively is like buckling down, right? When these offenses hit the money zone, 79th in points per trip allowed inside the 40, 64th in red zone defense. And you look at Texas, they've been fantastic. They usually get sevens when they get inside the red zone. Second best red zone offense in the country right now. So to me, situational football is going to be really, really important here. Colin Johnson, he looks to be closer to 100% after what I saw last week. It's going to make this offense much tougher to defend now, right? Because you can't cheat on Devin Duvernay. And I know it was the Jayhawks defense, but you look at Duvernay now that he's got some help out there. 80% success rate last week, caught 8 of his 10 targets. 6 of his 8 catches were either a first down or touchdown. So somehow TCU's got to figure out how to get pressure, avoid giving up the big play through the air, when Texas does start to move the ball, TCU has to hold them to three. If you can do those three things, again, TCU has a good chance to win here.
Interesting game on a number of levels. And when you look at way TCU has performed, they've been good at home when it comes to winning games straight up, going 12-4, albeit a lot of those against inferior opponents. They've actually been a miserable team to back as far as covering the number in their own building. 4-11 against the spread the last 15 home games. We'll see what gives and what'll basically become an elimination game in the Big 12 for probably one of these two teams. TCU a little bit more of a long shot to get to Dallas and have a chance at a conference championship, whereas a second loss for Texas probably would damn their chances as well, knowing how well things are going in Waco for Matt Rhule and the Baylor Bears. To the Big Ten, Payne, for a game that loses a little bit of its luster given Wisconsin's outright loss to Illinois despite being 29.5-point favorites, the second biggest underdog upset Illinois was able to accomplish in Champaign last weekend. And it's Ohio State right now, a 2-touchdown favorite at Foxbet, total on the game 50.5. This will be the first trip to Columbus for the Badgers since 2013. Of course, the last meeting between these programs came in the conference championship game in 2017, a game Ohio State won 27-21 as a modest 3.5-point favorite. When we look at the Badgers, and I know this was a spot you and I, we can openly admit, we had circled. We're hoping Wisconsin came in. Do we think the Badgers bounce back, and has that loss actually created some value on the underdog with this number ballooning out to two scores?
I have not seen anyone running Dake Wisconsin at this point. And yes, it would have been nice to lay something like, you know, 9.5 in this game. You know, when I look at this team, right, offensively, I still think there's some question marks at quarterback. Defensively, I'm not sure what Wisconsin is just because they haven't played anybody yet with an offensive pulse. But I think it's important to kind of start with the Badgers offense. At this point in the season, right, week 9, you would think we know what these teams are, but I'm not really sure what Wisconsin's offense is. Like, I think we're going to find out a ton about Jack Cohn. I think we're going to probably find out if Ohio State is, we've seen improvement, right? Stopping the run season over season. They've been outstanding in that, but let's see if they're truly elite in that category. When I look at what Wisconsin's done, and I think the goal, anytime you have a Wisconsin offense, you have to prepare to stop Jonathan Taylor. Keep him in check. If he goes for, you know, 100 or 125 yards, I think that's fine. Just make sure it's in like an inefficient 100 yards. And you look the last 3 weeks or the last three games against Power 5 teams, Taylor was held to a 39% success rate on runs against Illinois. Sparty held Taylor to 3.1 a carry. His long was only 13 yards. Northwestern kept Taylor in check, 4.6 a carry, 42% success rate. So you got to make Jack Cohn beat you. And I think when you look metrically, like across the board, Jack Cohn's exceeded expectations, right? But what's been on his plate? What has he been asked to do? When your defense is pitching 4 shutouts and you have Jonathan Taylor leading the offense, Jack Cohn hasn't really been forced to throw a ball in too many pressure situations. When he was last week, well,
yeah, didn't end
that's,
up, that's didn't
the
work
reason
so well
for the bagel no longer in the loss column, right? Hasn't been good. So, you know, if Ohio State removes Jonathan Taylor from the game, then what, right? Especially on the road. You look, Jack Cohn, he got Michigan. He got Northwestern. He got Sparty all at home. Ohio State's defense is a different beast right now. 27% success rate allowed on passes. 5th best in the country. You look, Wisconsin's passing offense hasn't proven to be overly dynamic either, right? Quintez Cephas is back. We thought this was going to be a huge addition. He has been, right? They probably wouldn't have a single explosive play if he wasn't on the field, but they're 104th in the country in explosive passing. So, you know, again, you go back and you look at a game even like Northwestern. Cohn completes 63% of his passes. It looks great, but are you beating Ohio State with like 4.3 yards per pass attempt? So, you look, in my mind, he's probably going to be forced to be a passer here. I just don't see a situation where Ohio State lets Jonathan Taylor beat them. You look at some of the mistakes he's made, and it's going to look good on paper. He's only got 2 interceptions, even though one of them was season-changing. But 7 passes have graded interceptable. So there's probably going to be some regression there at some point where he's going to start throwing a few more picks. The one question that we've had a little bit, and again, I mentioned it at the top, let's see how good Ohio State's run defense is. It was a problem last year, especially stopping explosive running backs. They get up just gobs of explosive runs. Last week against Northwestern, they gave up some runs early on in that game. There's the five real carries, right? Not sacks, which are included in rushing metrics. But the first five real carries went for 56 yards. Ryan Day kind of dismissed it in the postgame, said Northwestern had 2 weeks to prepare. And once we made adjustments, we did real well stopping the run. And he's right, right? After like the first two drives, if you remove sack yardage and the special teams issue there and only look at true running plays, Northwestern was held to under 3 yards a carry. So let's see if Ohio State is really elite stopping the run, as the metrics indicate they are. It's certainly been a massive improvement year over year. But, you know, again, in these games like this, you want multiple options. And I just have a tough time seeing if Jonathan Taylor is removed from this game, what Jack Cohn's going to be able to do.
Well, let's throw another log onto that fire as well. Wisconsin has yet to trail in a football game this season outside of that field goal that came as time expired against Illinois. So you want to talk about questions you have with Jack Cohn and his ability to stretch the field when Jonathan Taylor can get going. What does this Wisconsin offense look like if they have to play from behind? And the Buckeyes have been as proficient as anybody getting games started. Now, I won't say that quickly, because we saw them struggle in the first quarter against Michigan State before the offense got on track, in a similar scenario, albeit a lot different, again, against Northwestern, where they didn't look explosive. But I think that begs some watching as well.
To now, your on the point, though, Ryan Day has talked about all week about a fast start. So,
and I think it makes a ton of sense. And I think it makes a ton of sense. When you look at some of the offensive metrics, and people may be all too well aware of what Ohio State has done. Number 5 in the country in total offense, averaging over 525 yards per game. Number 3 in the nation in scoring, averaging more than 49 points per game. Number 3 in the nation in rushing offense, averaging 287 yards per game. The only two teams, mind you, that have been more proficient running the football in terms of raw yardage, both option teams in Navy and Air Force. They're winning games by an average of 41.7 points per game. Payne, it's almost as though you can pencil Ohio State in for 250 yards rushing and 200 yards passing against inferior foes, and now they'll step up in class at least against a Wisconsin team that should be stout. But we have questions all the time, not about the scheme that Jim Leonard calls in the back, but the athletes that the Badgers have and their ability to run sideline to sideline with guys that Ohio State's going to throw at them in space.
We're absolutely going to find out what Wisconsin's defense truly is. And, you know, I would think last week's defensive performance was probably a combination of looking past Illinois and ahead to Ohio State, and then Wisconsin's defense just being wildly overrated. And you look, heading into last week's game, in terms of overall offensive efficiency, Illinois was the best offense Wisconsin had faced to date, right? And Illinois goes out, they match the national average for yards per play. They ended the game with 9 explosives. I mean, listen, like 4 shutouts in 7 games, it's tough to overlook. But so is the fact that the average offensive efficiency ranking of Wisconsin's opponents is 88th. So that's the complete opposite of what Ohio State's offense has done, right? They faced 3 defenses that rank top 26 in overall efficiency. They've won those 3 games 128-13. So I think we do. We're going to find out, I think, pretty quickly if Wisconsin can handle Ohio State's speed and athleticism, to your point. And what I have seen from Justin Fields, and I know, you know, not everyone knows all the details behind the scenes, but he has shown an ability at this point to play multiple ways, which is, you know, I think 2 months ago or even 3 months ago was a big question mark. If you're going to be aggressive as a defense, he has no issues pushing the ball down the field, right? Right now, Justin Fields top 5 in passer rating on throws beyond 10 yards. Last week, Northwestern plays like their typical bend but don't break style. Fields acts like this like savvy veteran, right? You just watch him. He's taking what they give him. He's efficiently moving the ball down the field. Had a 58% passing success rate last week. On dropbacks last week where Fields was kept clean, complete 78% of his throws, 3 touchdowns, 139 passer rating. But you look on those throws, only average 7.8 yards per pass attempt. So again, like you can see, Fields is like willing to take the efficient short intermediate stuff because Northwestern wanted to keep everything in front. I think we also have to see how Wisconsin handles, you know, the explosiveness of Ohio State's ground game. You look at some of these metrics, despite playing like that horrific schedule of offenses that I've kind of mentioned a few times this season, Wisconsin's 40th in explosive run defense. So there could be some opportunities there, as you alluded to, for Dobbins to break some few long ones, even Fields to break a few long ones. One thing, though, that just doing a bunch of reading, getting a bunch of intel and information, we're going to have to monitor this because it's going to be huge. It's going to be crucial in this game. Left tackle for Ohio State, Thayer Munford. He's battling some injuries, didn't start the Northwestern game, did come in and battle, played, you know, some snaps. Ryan Day kind of called his effort gritty. So he's nowhere near 100%. Let's see if he starts. Let's see if the snaps are limited. That would be big to not potentially have your left tackle there, although I know the kid they brought in recruit is also a five-star recruit, probably one of the best in the country that filled in for him, but he's just, you know, not as experienced. Starting right tackle, Joshua Alibi, I believe his name is, didn't play last week. So you could potentially have two key cogs along the Buckeyes offensive line that are potentially beat up in playing or not playing all the snaps. We'll see. It's early Wednesday morning. We're recording this, and Ryan Day, kudos to him. He's usually mum on injury, so it's something that I know that I'm personally tracking this week as it progresses, Todd. So those would be two significant injuries along the O-line that we just have to monitor.
Fascinating game on a number of levels. We would love to have this Big Ten clash with a pair of unbeaten teams and a chance to capitalize on Ohio State against some of the Wisconsin overvaluation in the market. Let's see how they handle their first bit of adversity. And Ohio State, no stranger to taking on physical defenses. They dismantled one that they already played at home. We'll see if they pass this test with flying colors and further assert themselves as a viable national title contender. From the Big Ten, Payne, an afternoon kickoff down in Baton Rouge, where LSU is installed as a 10.5-point favorite as they welcome in Auburn. Total in this game at 58.5 at Foxbet. And when we look at these two teams, well, they've done what, or excuse me, bettors have done very well by them. A combined 11-1 against the spread versus FBS opponents. The only failure this year coming in Gainesville, a game Auburn lost as 3-point favorites, dropping that one 24-13. We look at recent history between these two teams, and it's really been owned by the home team going 8-2 against the number the last 10 meetings in the series. But I think the matchup everyone wants to watch is Joe Burrow against this Auburn defense. So for us, Payne, I want to start on the other side of the ball. I want to start with Bo Nix and the Auburn offense against an LSU defense. And I know a lot of people have questions about Nix and how he'll perform in his second true road test, but I love some of the poise he showed in his press conference saying, I learned a lot from that trip to Gainesville, things that I think I can use going forward in this kind of hostile atmosphere on Saturday.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's going to be fun to see here. Has Bo Nix taken another step in his growth and maturation as a quarterback? You know, 3 weeks ago at Florida, Nix was clearly rattled, and you look at some of the numbers and they back that up. Held to a 24% success rate on all passes in that game, completed 41% of his throws. On downs where Nix was forced to pass on a known passing down against Florida, 3 for 11, 1.1 yards per pass attempt. So, you know, let's see if Nix can improve. We know he's not close to what his peak is going to be as a passer. He has had the bye week since then. He had the tune-up game against Arkansas, who's, you know, outside the top 100 in defending the pass. But, you know, I know Bo Nix has handled the Florida game like a pro. He put all the blame on himself. He claimed he wasn't ready for that environment. Death Valley might even be a crazier spot come Saturday afternoon, I would think. And there's, you know, they're showing the clips of his dad where his dad was quarterback for Auburn, and there was like fake whistles going on, and you see him drop back in the end zone and he just like stops playing, and the LSU defender just slams him into the ground for a safety. They just stopped playing. They thought all the game had been that the referees had blown the whistle. So he's prepared for this situation, I would think. He's had three big games not at home this season. He's going to need some help from the ground game. And I think that's going to be a tough ask because Whitlow is their horse. I think that's a big loss in a game like this. Now, Cam Martin, he's been there for a while. You got the freshman, DJ Williams. He was awesome in the second half last week against Arkansas. So those two guys have to shoulder the load and help Nix out here. The LSU defense that Bo Nix is facing metrically, it isn't as good as Florida, A&M, or Oregon. So to me, this is now his fourth test. And, you know, all have been away from home. So I think, you know, he's probably going to be a little more situated for a game like this. I think he's got to be efficient, passing the ball over the middle of the field, which is where LSU has struggled to defend with Devin White moving on to the NFL. They've been extremely vulnerable in the middle of that field. LSU right now, you look, known for their corners. Everyone talks about DBU. 42nd in the country in passing success rate defense. When Gus does draw up the goods, right? Because inevitably there is going to be a trick play or two from what I'm hearing, right? Knicks has to deliver on a few of those deep shots. LSU's been vulnerable to that as well, 47th in explosive pass defense. So Knicks has to be a competent passer here. I think the positive, though, when you look down to down, dig into all these metrics, LSU hasn't shown an ability to get after the quarterback this season, especially on standard down. So for me, and I continue to hammer this point home, young quarterback, crazy environment. If I'm Gus, right, and I want Bo throwing the ball, it's going to be on early downs. Get his confidence up. 5-6 yards, efficient throws on first and second down. That's not only going to work, but I think it's probably confidence building. And again, LSU, their pressure and sack rate have dropped like dramatically season over season, and they've been horrific getting pressure on standard downs. So I think that's one of the keys to watch on this side of the ball. Can Bo Nix get confidence early passing the ball on those early downs? Because I think he's probably going to have a decent amount of time here to throw.
And Auburn, no stranger to blowing big leads in this rivalry recently. Double digits squandered away in each of the last two meetings. I believe the last three meetings have all been decided by 5 points or less. When the other side of the ball, it's strength on strength, Payne. And Joe Burrow right now, given the injury to Tua Tagovailoa, is actually the favorite to win the Heisman Trophy at Fox Bet, a price shade under 2-1. If you shopped around out here in the desert before the season, it would have been a nice flyer to have at 200-1 on Burrow, knowing the potential impact that Joe Brady could have. And when you look at LSU, number 3 in total offense, 8 of the last 10 years, Payne, they haven't been inside the top 50. 7 games so far, and LSU's lowest passing output was 293 yards. 24 incompletions for Burrow over the last 3 games. And when we look at some of these numbers, he even gets better when he's facing pressure this season, breaking records all over the place. If you're Auburn and your defensive coordinator, Kevin Steele, how do you go about trying to at least slow down one of the hottest hands in college football?
I know you're a Debbie Downer, but this is the matchup. This is the side of the ball that everyone
circled.
I'm
not Debbie Downer. I said this is the matchup everyone wants to see, but this might not be the matchup that decides the game, jackass.
Far and away, LSU's toughest test offensively. Far and away, Auburn's toughest test defensively. And Coach O and Joe Brady have made it abundantly clear that nothing is going to change offensively this week. They're going to protect with 5 guys, spread Auburn out. They're confident that their O-line is going to be able to protect. And to your point, if you look, Burrow's been pressured on only 19% of his dropbacks this season. And on known passing downs, LSU's only allowed a 5% sack rate. So they've been pretty good there. They've improved that offensive line. Part of the O-line success, though, is how Joe Brady mixes up his passing game. We've seen just different variations of the LSU passing attack. They can hit you short to intermediate where it's all about efficiency. You look, LSU number 1 in the country in passing success rate. Nearly 60% of LSU's passes this season have graded successful. But we've also seen Joe Burrow take some deep shots as well. LSU 7th in explosive passing. Joe Burrow's graded out the very best quarterback this season on passes where he targets receivers 10 or more yards down the field. So, you know, getting the ball out quickly can certainly annoy like a great defensive line like the one Auburn has with Derrick Brown. But I think when there's an opportunity to be had here, like LSU wants to push the ball down the field. If Burrow has time, I think he's clearly going to be successful here. We saw, right? There's a similar style here. We've seen Florida's offense with Dan Mullen and Kyle Trask kind of spread out that Auburn defense with its receivers over the middle of the field. You take advantage of some of those linebackers in space. But all in all, right, this is good on good. I think the team that covers this number will be the one that plays the best situational football on this side of the ball, right? Situational football is so important. We saw it Monday night in the NFL early on in that game. Jets Patriots. All right, situational football. What can you do on third down? What can you do in the red zone? So when you look at this, both the LSU offense and Auburn defense, top 10 in success rate on third downs. Both the LSU offense and Auburn defense, top 10 in green zone opportunity rate. Auburn and LSU, top 10 in red zone scoring. So something has to give here. Situational football and the execution on those three areas, I think are going to ultimately determine who gets the cover here.
And Marlon Davidson and Derek Brown, of course, the headliners for that Auburn defense. They'll need to continue their disruptive ways, but you look at Auburn's pass defense overall, 68th nationally in yards passing allowed per game at 224 and change. Should be interesting to see how they can solidify that stop unit. LSU will also get another receiver back, which allows the rich to get richer. Last thing on this particular game, Payne, when you look
I'm
at the
sure. number... I knew where you were going.
All right. I just wanted to ask because we saw where it opened and we've seen how the market has kind of moved. I wasn't sure if you were seeing anything in your circles.
I've seen a little. Yes. I don't know if it's overly strong yet to this point, but obviously, right. And this is a good indicator. And it's not, you know, you don't necessarily need to like rub elbows with the sharpest people to get a good indicator on where things are going, right? I would tell you. Obviously get an odd screen and you can compare books that take recreational money and boot winners versus books that are willing to take professional money. And you are looking right now. And again, it's early in the week. It's on Wednesday. Limits are low. Funny money is fully into the market yet. True positions haven't been, you know, not all true positions have been taken at this point, but you're looking at this line and in the lowest places are on the board or where all the sharp money gets bet. The highest places on the board are where all the square money comes in. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to have the intel I have to kind of figure this out as a better. And being able to read the market is extremely important. So just a general tip and rule, I would really make sure you get an odd screen and start comparing the sharpest books to the squarest books to figure out where some of this action's coming in.
It always helps as a great indicator. You may not be able to get the best of the number all the time, but it doesn't need to stop you from at least knowing what's going on and how money is trickling into the market, especially early in the week with some of the larger positions oftentimes taken on game day.
The spot I've alerted you to is quite telling, right?
Only it is
spot
the lowest.
Right now below double digits.
And it is awfully juicy should you be so inclined to bet the favorite and lay those points that as it sits below
this
the key
specific
number.
This specific spot right now is welcoming all professional bettors. And so it's a good spot to look at. So there you go.
When we look at one of the other games on the board, of course, it loses a little bit of its luster. One team relegated to just kind of playing for pride, for a lack of a better term. That squad being the Michigan Wolverines, as they'll welcome in Notre Dame, the Irish fresh off a bye. And since we started recording, we've seen a little bit of money come trickling in and a new team is installed as the favorite. Notre Dame now moved to a 1-point chalk at Fox Bet. Total on the game sits at 50.5. I guess the best place to start, Payne, before we get into some of the X's and O's and on-field matchups and Michigan motivation, the Irish being an outside shot of getting into the college football playoff discussion, is the number and the strong stance odds makers took opening this number with Michigan more than a field goal favorite.
I saw some places open 4. Listen, I don't really like Michigan much this season, but that number was pretty telling. We have seen early money on Notre Dame. I have no idea where this is going right now. I really don't. I can tell you that the guys that I speak with haven't done anything on this game yet. And the sentiment was potentially, let's see how high this game can get.
Well, it makes a ton of sense if Wednesday morning we're already talking about shifting favorites here. We'll see where some of that momentum subsides. Quick notes on the series. Michigan, as we know all too well, documented 1-9 against top 10 opponents under head coach Jim Harbaugh, but the Wolverines have compiled a 28-4 record straight up at home during Harbaugh's tenure. When we look at Michigan's offense, Payne, we know that this group hasn't lived up to the expectations that a lot of people had. They haven't taken to Josh Gattis's style the same way LSU has Joe Brady coming in as the passing coordinator. But is it fair to ask if the offense maybe found something or at least a semblance they can build on given that second half comeback against Penn State and the fact that they were one drop pass in the end zone away for maybe even pulling off a major upset despite spotting the Nittany Lions a 21-0 lead early in that contest?
If you can get over the mental hurdle of the drop pass, I would think so, right? And the one question mark I think we've had with Michigan State and their coaching staff is being able to make adjustments. And the one thing that we did see in the Penn State game was they came out of halftime more prepared. They made those adjustments just in quarter three alone. The Michigan Wolverines offense had a 45% success rate to Penn State's 8%. So we saw the adjustments that we were looking to see from Michigan's offense. They had two nice drives in the second half. When you factor in the opponent, the environment, I think you could probably debate Michigan played its most complete three consecutive quarters of football in a row this past Saturday, I would think, right? In total, they were a net positive 9% in success rate against Penn State for the entire game. They had outgained Penn State by 134 yards. So this wasn't a loss where we downgraded Michigan at all. I honestly upgraded them a half a point. So that's why this number, I think, is really interesting, as we talked about. Shea Patterson has to continue to grow. That's the biggest part of this offense, right? The running backs, we had question marks coming into the season. There's going to be a lot of different faces. There's going to be a lot of young guys. Things Zach Charbonnet, you know, he showed pretty well. 5.4 carry against a good Penn State defense, delivered a 47% success rate. Hopefully that's your horse moving forward now that he has some confidence and we're at the latter part of the season. But Shea Patterson really needs to be the driving force, right? He needs to continue to improve. We did see some improvement from him against Penn State, and it's a great data point to look at just because Penn State's defense is the best that they've faced this season. At this point, the environment was the toughest they've faced in this season. And you look, Shea Patterson, when he was forced to throw in known passing situations, 12 for 18, completed 67% of those passes. He just has to start valuing the football more, right? He did have the costly interception. He did take a costly sack. So that's the biggest thing for this Michigan offense. If they're truly going to take this next step, and we're starting to get to that point where, you know, you talk to a lot of coaches, you talk to a lot of former players, you talk to a lot of, you know, heady players, quarterbacks, things of that nature. They tell you it takes about 7, 8, 9 games to get truly acclimated to a new system. We're kind of at that point for Josh Gattis's new system in this offense, but it comes down to Shea Patterson, really. What Shea Patterson are we getting? Are we going to get the second half Shea Patterson? Are we going to get the Shea Patterson that, you know, treats the ball like, I'm not going to use the verbiage I usually use, but he's got to start valuing the football. Those are the keys to this game.
Irish defense, I mean, I still have some major questions. I don't feel that they faced a really daunting schedule of opposing offenses. Yes, they acquitted themselves nicely on the road in Athens for a major showdown earlier this season, but the more we watch Georgia giving up 23 points to the Bulldogs doesn't seem to be as difficult to feat as it once appeared. They face Louisville, New Mexico, Georgia, the aforementioned Bulldogs, Virginia, Bowling Green, and USC. What do we make of the Irish on the defensive side of the ball themselves?
Well, they've had 2 weeks to prepare, so I think that's going to be a positive. And we've seen, you know, some game plans that were, I thought, very good against Virginia defensively, very good against Georgia, although that could have been attributed to like a really conservative game plan, which we're really seeing from Kirby Smart at this point as head coach.
Yeah, it might not be a conservative game plan down there in Georgia. It just might be their offense.
No, they're pretty conservative. They don't run a lot of snaps. Georgia has not. Kirby Smart's been a great recruiter. He's got the talent in, hasn't figured out when you have that much talent, we want to run more plays than the other team. That would be that would go a long way. Hasn't figured out how to do that yet. So that's the issue there with Georgia's offense. But to get back to Notre Dame's defense, the one real offense that we like is USC. And USC shredded them, went up and down the field, especially in the second half. They were well above 55% success rate as a game for the entire game offensively. That was with Keaton Slovis, a true freshman quarterback in a tough environment, just coming back off a concussion, hadn't played in multiple weeks. He shredded those guys. And if it wasn't for, you know, some early rust that we kind of alluded to, the first five possessions where USC kind of fizzled out at midfield and in the green zone, USC is going to win that game because of their offense. So there still is some components of this Notre Dame defense, specifically in the secondary, that you can exploit a little bit.
On the other side of the ball, Michigan's defense appears to have regained some of its form, swagger. You can use whatever adjective you'd like. Since the Wisconsin game, Michigan has given up just 53 yards per game on the ground, holding their opposition to 1.6 yards per carry. I know there's sack yardage baked in there as well. And they haven't faced a team that's probably going to attack them the same way as the Irish. Notre Dame showed their ability. You mentioned that USC game. They ran absolutely wild. Tony Jones, over his last three games, 50 carries, 400-plus yards, has shown himself to be the Irish's bell cow. When I look at that particular matchup, veteran quarterback and Ian Book, some limited capabilities as far as athletes, in my estimation, in his receiving core, how does Notre Dame stack up against this Michigan defense that's shown to be very good on occasion? The Iowa, the perfect illustration, when they made life miserable for Nathan Stanley, but has also shown some frailty in trying to defend offenses that actually have a pulse and the ability to show some balance.
Yeah, you know, metrically speaking, this is the toughest defense Notre Dame's faced. And, you know, obviously 2 weeks to prepare, and that's while, like, Michigan was just in this high-intensity situation and getting their hearts ripped out on a drop touchdown last week. So, situationally, Notre Dame is in the far superior spot here. But Michigan players and coaches are saying all the right things, right? How their season isn't done, how this is a big rivalry game. And if we get that same energy and effort, which is what it takes to play defense, this is a big test for Notre Dame. If you go back and look, right, against these elite defenses, against these major programs, Notre Dame's offense hasn't been very good the last whatever it is, you know, 10 months or so, right? They fell flat on their face, crushed by Clemson in the playoff last year. You look this season against Georgia. Dame is held to a 39% success rate and 5.2 yards per play, both below the national average. Ian Book throws two picks in that game, 5.8 yards per pass attempt. Against Virginia's defense, Notre Dame is held below the national average in both success rate and explosiveness. Ian Book, again, averages 5.6 yards per pass attempt, to your point about not having those dynamic weapons outside. Even at home, against USC in this true freshman quarterback returning from this massive concussion, Notre Dame is a net negative 8% in success rate, right? So, like, sure, offensively, Dame was more than fine in that game, but still couldn't outperform the opposing offense metrically in yards per play or success rate. So it's difficult to assess this. Again, I'm intrigued to see where the number goes. And again, if Michigan just isn't completely spent, stylistically, there is some similarities from what the Wolverines defense saw last week, right? Mobile quarterback. They did a really good job taking away Sean Clifford, his legs last week. They made him a thrower. Clifford was held to 24 yards on 9 carries, a 22% success rate rushing. Obviously not a good job defending KJ Hamler once you force Clifford to be a passer. Good God. And so I think that's going to be the big thing here. Can Michigan show and continue to improve stopping the ground game, because you kind of alluded to the Irish getting some guys back in the running back room that have really made their offense a little bit more dynamic. So that's the big thing here. Can Michigan, they've changed some things on the defensive line. They've gotten guys healthier. They're playing younger guys. They've really improved their defensive line since the beginning portion of the season. So that's a good battle here. But they have faced the mobile quarterback in Sean Clifford last week, so it's not going to be too much of a shock to the system. Where Notre Dame could have the advantage here is in the red zone. They have been very efficient with situational football. It doesn't shock me. And Michigan's defense, 69th in red zone touchdown percentage. So when the Irish get down there, it's vital, just looking at Michigan's offense, obviously, that the defense for the Wolverines only allow 3.
Well, I mean, the one thing, too, that we've seen from Michigan is they've struggled against athletic receivers, especially on the crossing routes and everything else. From watching Notre Dame, and I'm not going to claim to be sitting there with a stopwatch watching guys like Cole Kmet and Chase Claypool, those guys don't have the same game-breaking potential of KJ Hamler. They're more plotters and what I would call possession receivers. I'd have to think that's actually a benefit for a Michigan secondary that's going to give them a little bit of reprieve.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And the one thing that Michigan tends to see is plotting receivers. There's an interesting story here, and I read it yesterday, and it kind of just hit me right now, but kind of proves to what we've said, and this is not necessarily this specific matchup, but Florida football in general, Michigan football in general, rather. Since Harbaugh's kind of arrived, right, like, they've been all about physicality and big guys and not so much speed. Josh Gattis, obviously the new OC, was actually at Penn State from 2014 to 2017. He was the one that recruited KJ Hamler to Penn State, right? Michigan was also recruiting him. Hamler basically said he didn't know if he'd fit at Michigan because he was smaller, faster, and quicker, and they recruited big guys. And so ultimately, he chose Penn State. So to your point here, Notre Dame doesn't have that dynamic threat in the pass game that's just going to like blaze away. And that has been what really has given Michigan's defense some issues because, you know, they really don't see it at practice. So that is a benefit here. And I think we watched every snap of the Iowa game. God, that was painful to watch. But even Iowa's receivers.
Those are three and a half hours of our life that we're not going to get back. Now, thankfully, it was a winner, but I'm still not going to get that time back.
Even Iowa receivers were killing the linebackers in space on these crossing routes for Michigan. So it's something to watch for in this game for sure.
One final note, we've seen this long-standing historic rivalry. Yes, they've taken a little bit of sabbatical from time to time, but over the last 9 meetings, the home team has covered 8 of the 9. So if you're a Michigan believer, you have to hope home cooking will be their benefit, especially if they ultimately move to a home underdog at all of your favorite shops. Friendly reminder, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. You can follow me there as well at Todd Furman. And of course, you can follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. 5 big games broken down as eloquently as you're going to find anywhere in the business. But there is one final order of business to take care of before we bid you a fond farewell. And our best bet is brought to you by FoxBet. The biggest name in sports is now the hottest name in sports betting and one of the fastest growing betting apps out there. Whatever sports you like betting on, FoxBet has you covered. You can download the app to your smartphone from absolutely anywhere and place real money wagers on dozens of sports and events with the easy-to-use app in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. FoxBet, make the call, download the app today. Payne, where are we going to keep this college football heater completely on the tracks?
Todd, let's go with your favorite offense in all of college football this week.
You're not going to do it, are you? You're not going to make me watch this team from start to finish again and hope that they can put together a drive, not only getting 7, but just crossing midfield, are you?
We're going with 162. Michigan State.
Hold on. Oh, I was going to pull up my screen and try and see. All right. Sparty it is.
We're going Michigan State plus the points. Extremely cheap buy to 7 now that the favorite is juiced here a little bit. I'm looking right now. I can get 7 minus 15.
I can get 7 minus 20 best available on my end.
I still like that with the total at 43 and a half, 44. So
official grading, I was going to ask, we going to go with 7 minus $1.20 or do you want to call it 6.5?
Yeah, let's call it 7 minus 20 for official grading. That works.
Okay.
And I do think, and again, with a total this low, it does make sense getting that buy, especially with... and you hope that this doesn't happen, or actually, I guess we probably do hope. you know, with the overtime rules, how they are set, it still does make sense getting to 7, especially with a lower total. So,
although it's nice, the one nice thing about overtime is that once you get to the third overtime and you have an underdog and you've dodged the bullet, you can only lose by 2 points. I found it fascinating to watch it for the first time since its inception last week in that Virginia Tech North Carolina game.
There you go. This just, you know, we've broke this game down ad nauseum. And I think it was, you know, obviously one of our big 5. So if you're just kind of tuning into this portion, we did break it down earlier in the show. This just feels, man, like the last hoorah here for Michigan State. If we're not going to, there's a couple of times throughout the course of the year that you just expect a little better effort and a little more focus. Having a bye and then another bye next week, like this is their lone focus, Penn State. So this would be a big win to get back on track, I think. And I like what I'm hearing from like the depth chart. Guys are getting healthier this week. A couple guys on the offensive line have been added to the depth chart this week. So I do like that aspect of things.
All right. Michigan State it is, plus the 7 on the bye against Penn State. Let's hope the Nittany Lions hit a wall after playing 2 extremely emotional and physical games that took them into the waning seconds. Michigan State shook him in fresh. And as we talked about during the main portion of the show, Michigan State, a unique scheduling quirk, bye week coming in, bye week coming out, a chance to really salvage their season and finish strong. Payne, before we let our listeners go and you offer words of advice, you're a guy that loves to put himself in situations where he has an edge. That's correct, right?
I feel like I divulged something I probably shouldn't have.
Hold on. Go with me on the train of thought. You like to put yourself in a position where you like to have an edge, whether it's a couple percentage points here or something a little bit more significant. That would be how you typically live your life, whether it's buying real estate, whether it's buying, you know, $9,000 slippers you walk around in your home. You have to feel like you're getting value.
I actually should cut this conversation off because I just got a call on the bat line, but because it's on the same phone right now, I can't answer it now that we're recording. Although that probably provides some crazy value here to this podcast.
There is a very good chance. But last night.
So where are you going with this?
Well, last night we talked about what you did. You got out in public. You went to watch your beloved Penguins. You engage in a behavior that we would put more on par with that weekend warrior and that recreational better mentality. Do you care to disclose? You have the right to not self-incriminate. So I'm going to give you that option.
Yeah, it was more for charity.
Okay.
It's more for charity.
Did you use the company card then?
Get involved in the 50-50. Get involved in the 50. Plus, from a value perspective, Todd, and I'm saying this facetiously and sarcastically, I looked at the board. $10 for 10 tickets. $20 for 60 or $40 for 150. That's value right there. So no, more of a charity thing. And then I said to myself, man, the way we're running right now in the NFL, if the gambling gods have a heart or a soul, we might luck into something here, and I might be able to pay for this chicken tender and French fry dinner.
Yeah, I mean, you knew that wasn't going to be the case, but it does remind me of a funny story, and I'll leave it at that because I know the guy who said this to me actually listens to our podcast every week. He says, you know, when you look at it, the 50-50 raffle, you really have a 50% chance to win. I said, how the hell do you figure that? He says, you know, you either win the thing or you lose the thing. There's two different outcomes, 50-50. That's how I choose to go about it.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I don't adhere to that thought process, but hey, to each his own.
We're proud of your charitable donation. Yeah. We're proud of your charitable donation. We just had to reveal some of the humanizing element
donation to the human fund either. So
no, well, that's what I was going to say. It actually went to a real living, breathing charity. So we're proud of you for that. And on that note, I want to thank all of you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in as you do each and every week. We continue to set all sorts of records around here as far as listenership for the Bet the Board podcast. Encourage you to tune in both to the college and NFL editions. We do this every Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And of course, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Michigan State on the bye, +7, -$1.15 if you can, -$1.20 is still okay in our books. And come Saturday afternoon, as the sun starts to set on the East Coast, we'll see you at the window.